At Wordsworth's and John Ruskin's beloved Thirlmere, in the Lake District, Britain's first national campaign to preserve a piece of local landscape emerged. Beginning there, and featuring interviews with experts on Wordsworth, Ruskin, William Blake and William Morris, this programme questions some of the conventional wisdom about English literature and modern environmentalism.
The birds have just gone quiet now. It's all gravity-fed from here, so it's quite an inexpensive source, if you will. When Manchester was found out that it was secretly trying to buy land in the area before the statutory process had been gone through...
I'm James Woodhouse, and I'm listening to Ian Brodie from Friends of the Lake District, a yard from the lapping water of Thirlmere.
This is one of the late 19th century... Manchester City growing as a city, an industrial city, Liverpool growing as well. And this was really the first national amenity battle that was fought in Britain for other than economic reasons. I mean, the loss of common land.
I've come here because it was around Thirlmere in the mid to late 1870s that Britain's first national campaign to preserve a piece of local landscape emerged. This was landscape which, earlier, had been a massive inspiration to William Wordsworth. In this programme, I want to investigate both the continuities and the differences between the 19th century Romantic poets and modern-day environmentalism. In the mid-1870s, Manchester Corporation ran the city that was the centre of British industrialisation. It tried to and succeeded in damming Thirlmere, one of the 13 lakes in the Lake District, so as to turn it into a reservoir and supply a million Mancunians with water. But around this lonely, verdant place, aesthetes and many others took on Manchester's city fathers. And though the Thirlmere Defence Association lost its battle, it became a kind of distant template for the continuing campaigns of environmentalists today.
There had been different kinds of resistance. The footpaths protection movement already existed.
Harriet Ritvo, professor of history at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston, USA, is the author of The Dawn of Green, a book about Thirlmere to be published later this year.
Wordsworth had tried to spark resistance to the first railway to come into the Lake District, but the Thirlmere Defense Association was the first such organization to get the kind of traction, national attention and sympathy and so forth, that we associate with such resistance movements subsequently.
In his book, The Song of the Earth, published in 2000, Jonathan Bate, professor of English literature at Warwick University, establishes Wordsworth and other 19th century romantic writers as Britain's first environmentalists. I think that's right, as long as we remember that people like John Ruskin, William Morris, and, before Wordsworth, William Blake, weren't just fond of nature. Their eulogies were not just to landscape, but also to man and his works. That key difference between 19th century thinking and 21st century environmentalism contains, I feel, some important political lessons for us today. Juliet Barker, whose home perches halfway up a steep-sided Pennine Valley, is an acclaimed biographer of William Wordsworth.
You're surrounded by birdsong on a wonderful morning, just akin to the sort he wrote about. What do you think his attitude to the environment and to nature can best be summed up as?
He's been caricatured very much as being somebody who wanted to preserve everything in aspic and was very selfish. He didn't want other people to share the beauties of the Lake District because all he cared about was that he could enjoy it personally. But that's such an unfair description of him.
Thinking about what your view of Wordsworth is, it seems to me that he was celebrating the human spirit quite a lot in his fondness for nature. I'm not sure that that's always the case with today's environmentalists.
No, I think not. I think we see a wider picture and we see the importance of preserving the planet, basically, as environmentalists today. But for Wordsworth, nature was actually so important as part of the human spirit. He believed passionately that people who were unhappy or living miserable lives could get a major benefit out of seeing nature in all its glory. The whole point about all his poetry that people often forget is not that he's celebrating the beauties of nature. He's celebrating them because they relate to people.
Wordsworth, it's true, could take a lofty attitude to tourists in the Lake District. In Peter Bell, too, he famously indicted his subject, a potter, for failing to appreciate the beauties of nature.
He roved among the vales and streams, in the green wood and hollow dell. They were his dwellings night and day, but nature ne'er could find the way into the heart of Peter Bell. In vain, through every changeful year, did nature lead him as before. A primrose by a river's brim, a yellow primrose, was to him, and it was nothing more.
At the same time, Wordsworth often showed a solidarity toward men and women, rather absent from those environmentalists who today are out to curb everyone's driving, flying, and general carbon footprint. In The Ruined Cottage, written in 1798 and then revised, he upheld
that secret spirit of humanity, which mid the calm, oblivious tendencies of nature, mid her plants and weeds and flowers and silent overgrowings, still survived.
He wrote most of his poetry for the intelligent working man, and it's significant that his sales as a poet rocketed once he'd realised that his real market was not the aristocrats that people at the early 19th century wrote for, but actually the working man who was going to be self-educated and who wanted to expand his horizons. And so that's why so much of his poetry is written about the humble people of the Lake District. And a lot of aristocrats said, well, you're putting aristocratic sentiments into the mouths of the common people, and they wouldn't have really felt like that. And he's saying, basically, we've all got one human feeling.
Upon Westminster Bridge. Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. This city now doth like a garment wear the beauty of the morning, silent, bare. Ships, towers, domes, theatres.
What inspired that poem or work on London that he, you know, liked so much about London that time? Because you'll never find a modern-day environmentalist saying a city is a good thing. You know?
No, absolutely not. The thing about Wordsworth is that he always felt that he had to go to London. He needed to get out of the lakes because you become sated, as it were, with the beauty, and you forget that elsewhere there are places that are different. And what he loved about London was the energy and the hum of life and the fact that there were so many people around and that they're all busy and they're all doing things and they're creating things.
He doesn't sound at all like an environmentalist.
Well, no, not, well, what happened was no. Exactly.
There is one kind of environmental campaign which does link the attitudes of some modern environmentalists with the likes of Wordsworth and Ruskin, and it can be seen in microcosm at Thirlmere. Harriet Ritvoe again.
There is a large subset that I would say descends directly from the 19th century Wordsworth-Ruskin point of view, which is the part that responds to threats to what is conceived of as either pristine wilderness or sometimes Edenic nature, lost paradise. You can see that those two kinds of characterization derive from stories that are rather different, but they share a sense of something unspoiled being ruined, polluted by human sin. If you look at the magazines that are put out by something like the American Sierra Club, if you just read the headlines, you can see language that is redolent of that, you know, in article after article. That's not the whole of the environmental movement. There are also components of it that recognize there is no place that is untouched by human activity and that preservation in those terms is a guaranteed lost cause.
Given how much I was struck by the beauty of Thirlmere, it was a bit of a surprise to hear Ian Brodie's fierce riposte to my praise for its astonishingly pristine look.
The fact that you see water and trees and open fells in the landscape,
looking so great.
But yet, you look at the trees around the valley. You could just as well be in America as the Lake District, seeing Sitka spruce and lodgepole pine and larch trees planting all round. It is not a characteristic English Lake District. We've lost the genus loci of the area. We lost the farmers from the area. any tree, a Sitka spruce tree, can look absolutely beautiful, absolutely marvellous, particularly in its local setting.
I mean, a mini, Yosemite in England is pretty nice.
What we're saying here is, you know, this is a Lakeland tree. This is a world brand. This is iconic landscape, because this is where the Romantic movement started. It's not what we have which is beautiful, it's what we've lost which may be more beautiful.
Like many conservationists, Ian feels a strong sense of loss. But I'm not sure the man on the Clapham omnibus would notice the desecration of Thirlmere without it being pointed out to him. If Wordsworth had still been alive to witness the creation of the reservoir, he probably would have joined Ruskin in resisting it. But that wouldn't mean that Ruskin was right. In reactionary style, Ruskin wrote that Manchester should be drowned by the water it wished to steal. Harriet Ritvoe.
Thirlmere was transformed, and it was transformed in a way that fulfilled the dire predictions. But the water was certainly needed, and the benefits to Manchester of the additional water were very noticeable, including something that was not part of the agenda, but because of agitation among the less affluent citizens of Manchester in the late 19th century, it was the Thirlmere water pretty much that was used to get piped water into modest dwellings in Manchester, which they didn't have on the whole before. So everyone's hopes and fears were realized.
It's these rooms at the front of the original house. It sort of was extended towards the end of Ruskin's life by his cousin, which is why it looks a much bigger pile, as it were, than it was really intended as quite a modest.
Maybe because he lived so close to Thirlmere, maybe because the view of Coniston from his front window was of similar bucolic glory, Ruskin certainly took the campaign for Thirlmere to heart. But even with Ruskin, who broadly thought that black slaves in America were naturally inferior to their white masters, nature wasn't the whole story.
To do justice to Ruskin's idea of nature, you have to put man at the centre of the equation.
Howard Hull is the director of Brantwood, Ruskin's home, high up on the eastern slopes above Coniston.
Ruskin believed man is the consciousness of nature. Without man, nature doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist.
That's very interesting.
And therefore, from our perspective, nature is an essentially human-related force. That doesn't mean to say that it is less than human or only human, but it comes to us in relationship to ourselves.
So why did he become so passionately involved in the Thirlmere issue? Apart from NIMBYism, Harriet Ritvoe, who sides with Ian Brodie in believing that much has been lost at Thirlmere, nevertheless suggests that, at the time, Ruskin was not the man he once had been.
In Ruskin's protests, particularly with regard to Thirlmere, which, as you know, was a kind of obsession with him in the years right as he was losing his intellectual grip, you see him not worrying about the effect of the scheme on people, but over and over about its effect on the lake itself, the valley itself.
Ruskin's crusty disdain for Manchester wasn't an aberration, but nor was it a complete guide to the man. He was very interested in the balance between man and nature, but often recognised man's preeminence in this relationship. In his Modern Painters, 1856, after all, nature famously contained for Ruskin no human capabilities, sensations, or emotions.
Going back to Thirlmere, basically he calls them thieves, and now his language is full of all of this. But the reason that he's so angry about it, in part, is because of something that he sees as a really important environmental issue, which is the whole business of displacement. As far as Ruskin is concerned, everything has a cost, everything relates. So you always see the relationship of things. And if people set out to do something and create something, what's the true cost of it that they're doing in relation to the value of what they're creating? So if you want to build Venice, you've got to go and quarry your stone from some mountain, you've got to log trees and all the rest of it. But the point is, you create Venice at the end of it. So the fact that you've got hollow canyons of quarries elsewhere on the mainland that have been mined, the fact that you've got forests that have been cut, the fact that you've done all these various things to create Venice is a cost that you pay.
And he's prepared to bear that
and
cost.
And he's prepared to
in
bear
a way that,
cost.
Many people today might be
because
much more
Venice
worried about.
Because Venice is worth
it. Yeah, well, he's right about that.
But his anger with Manchester is that Manchester is not worth it. Mm. Because he says, you know, I've been to Manchester, I've lectured at Manchester, I've told them that they can't produce one piece of good art.
I wonder if you could just say a little bit about Ruskin's attitude to materials. Every time I hear environmentalists today talk about materials, it's always about how they shouldn't be brought from anywhere beyond a 1 kilometre radius. Did Ruskin go that far about materials and food and these sorts of things?
No, but he was very conscious of the fact that things did travel distances and that different people were involved in making different things. In fact, that the whole network that supports all of us is dispersed. This notion that things have cost, that they have a relationship to something that may be out of sight that feeds into them, is something that Ruskin is interested in quantifying. There's a wonderful description. Ruskin always likes to start some of his ideas from personal experience when he's discussing things. There's a wonderful description when he's in the study at Brantwood, and it's early morning and he's got up and he started work and it's winter and he's saying, at this very moment, 7:30, I'm pacing my study, and half an hour ago the fire was lit for me. At this moment, somebody is walking in from the village with watercress for my breakfast. The postman will be here in another hour and a half. And then gradually the picture widens and talks about the fisherman out at sea who is catching fish for his breakfast in a few days' time. Her bootmaker in London who's sending these boots up. And so you gradually get this sense of the way in which his individual life is supported by this network.
But that's all very good. But he's not attacking this dependence.
He's not.
Exploring it. No. He might want to put a cost to it.
Well, that's,
but in some ways he's celebrating it, is he not?
This is exactly the point. The point is really, it all depends on what the nature of that cost is and what the nature of that result is. So he's looking at the whole equation and looking at the balance of all these things.
So if it's to build Venice, then it doesn't matter how...
But that's a decision for us to make.
Of course.
That's something for us to evaluate.
It's a little more nuanced than what we often hear today about, you know, food miles or construction miles or all of these things.
One of the problems with that is that we are using, actually, precisely the problematic equations to measure these things by, because we're saying we're separating all these items one from another, and we're also looking for big prescriptions. We're in a big systems society, so we tend to look for big prescription answers, and yet what we're looking at here are problems which have much more subtlety and much more variety and much more individual issues at stake than a single global prescription. In other words, if people who are against globalism are reduced by globalism to only being able to give a global prescription to solve globalism, in a way you've begun to sort of... I think that is a problem in the environment, because different things in different places, in some cases the cost is worth it, in others it isn't.
Before and after Wordsworth came two more Williams, Blake and Morris. With both, and most famously with Blake, there's a love of the countryside. This is a hymn which, based on Blake's poem, means many different things to many different kinds of people. Shirley Dent, co-author of Radical Blake, Afterlife and Influence from 1827, insists we tread our way round Jerusalem with care.
Everyone from the BNP to the Jarrow Marchers to the Women's Institute have claimed Jerusalem. The problem with Jerusalem, it is both a reactionary and a progressive hymn. So you do have this kind of looking back to a mythological golden age of the green and pleasant land with Joseph of Arimathea sort of knocking around in it. At the same time, we need to give Blake some credit here and always remember that he's reading this through the human form divine, through the imagination. So when he talks about the dark satanic mills, and they're often quoted as, you know, these industrial, you know, monoliths of horror, essentially they're about the intellectual dark satanic mills. They're about the limits of how we think, how we imagine the world could be.
Blake was rapturous about nature, but once again, human beings were his main priority.
What we can't get away with Blake is that he lived in a time, he lived in a city where people did live in a very degraded state, where pollution, etc., could be a problem. I think the difference is always, always, always for Blake, it's about the human at the centre of that. So if you look at the chimney sweep from Songs of Innocence and Experience, that's all about the condition of those young children. Horrific conditions, okay? What I think today's environmentalists could learn from Blake and take from Blake is to put the human at the centre of that, rather than saying that nature is some entity of its own that Blake was trying to in some way argue for or protect or give him special privilege to. That's simply not true.
The better part of a century after Blake, William Morris was both a leader of the arts and crafts movement and also a socialist. On balance, it's probable that he'd give short shrift to today's green etiquette of carbon-free personal transport and organic food.
I think that he would really loathe the sort of complacency which one is aware of in the movement. Like the thing that you mention about the correct conversation at dinner parties.
Fiona McCarthy, author of a noted biography of Morris.
And the sort of competitiveness that seems to have come about in this green movement of today. I think Morris would have poured scorn on this and would probably have made some very funny jokes about it.
Like Morris, Fiona McCarthy's family run a factory. She's married to David Meller, a noted designer and cutler. The family's factory blends effortlessly with the surrounding Peak District countryside. Its eco-friendly Derbyshire stone exterior and rural setting may lead you to believe that it's some kind of community enterprise, but it isn't. It makes very beautiful and rather expensive cutlery. It's high-end capitalism, neither dirty nor cheap.
People often get Morris wrong on this. He was in favour of machinery, as long as machinery was making things better, both in terms of what the machines were producing and also in terms of improving the lives of the people who were using the machinery. I mean, he had a very human view of the whole issue. He felt that that the workers were losing touch with what they were making through the processes of industrialization, and also that they were being forced into inhuman sort of lives in the way that the factory environment was appalling, in the way that their housing was what Morris called rabbit hutches.
Once again, a romantic who venerated the landscape, but someone who was also quick to place humans before birds and butterflies.
I think he saw that technology could be a humanising factor in that it could cut out the very laborious sort of elements in making things and free the people who were working in the factories to be more creative and more self-reliant in setting their own standards. So he saw this, but actually, of course, making it happen, as he himself knew from having his own factory, was no easy task, and indeed it still isn't an easy task. But it was there in his thinking.
If Wordsworth were alive today, do you think he would be keen on today's environmentalists, or would he be worried that they didn't have that generosity and magnanimity toward the human spirit that he himself evinced?
I don't think he would have been happy with the way that environmentalists work today. Not so, well, I think he would have been concerned about the fact that they ignore human concerns, but I think he would have been deeply worried by the short-termism of a lot of the solutions, the fact that people leap from one solution to the next and don't see the problems that those things are going to arise. People keep bringing up, you know, the golden solution that's going to cure all, and then suddenly you find out all the downside. And Wordsworth was always, stand back, think through, take the long-term view.
Greens today make a lot of fuss about happiness, and so does New Labour. And lots of American academics say, you know, we've had increasing gross domestic product, but no increasing happiness. Therefore, why have wealth? Why have growth? And you know, given that our aim, like the utilitarians, is happiness, what would Ruskin say about that? Were he alive today?
Well, I think Ruskin. I don't think Ruskin was a. Would have been hugely sympathetic to the idea that we should just have nothing but perpetual happiness. That again goes back slightly to the idea of cost,
and also work.
But work, duty, and so forth.
Achievement.
And Ruskin didn't believe that the world was without pain, or that any individual's life would ever be without pain. The idea that somehow or other we can avoid those things, discomfort or difficulty and so forth.
And he also had a higher end in mind than just sort of having a great time.
Very much so.
Wordsworth, Ruskin, Blake and Morris were all contradictory individualists. We can only guess what they would make of modern environmentalism. In their day, each considered man's relationship with nature, but the field of what is now known as ecology was still foreign to them. For the Romantic poets, there were no trendy green concepts such as natural capital or ecosystem services. For them, nature was not a vengeful Gaia out to pay man back for his misdeeds, but rather something that could help reaffirm the spiritual character of man and his ability to transcend the status quo. In this sense, at least, nature exists to serve man's needs and not the other way round. For all the sometimes parochial protests they tied themselves to, the Romantic poets wanted above all to celebrate a humankind which strives to better itself. Their naturalism was orientated not to limiting man's scope, but to encouraging a greater creativity and impact on the world than was available to people during Victorian industrialisation. For all their eccentric ambiguities, the Romantic poets believed in their fellow men and women in a way that modern environmentalism does not. They didn't indict you and me for our excessive personal consumption, but upheld the possibility of human transcendence through art, design, and ingenuity. In these dark and gloomy days, that shining side of the Romantics is worth remembering.